you everybody, and it's good to see the number that we do have here. As Peter said, whether by many or by few, it doesn't really matter. We're here because of a common love for the things of God, and that's what we want to share together, and we want to see this type of meeting grow in this city, and we want to incorporate more and more people, both in an evangelistic role and in a supporting role, those who are already Christians, who want to know more about the God that we worship. Now, it's a really, really nice day today, as everyone can see. It's a really good day for fishing. Hands up here, those who like fishing. There's been a few fishermen in the audience. I'm going to start my talk today with a little fishing story. How many of you know about the big Murray River cod?
Yeah.
Okay, you know a bit about them? Right. They're reasonably scarce now, and they're protected. But at one time when they were catching cod on the Murray River... One time when they were catching cod on the Murray River, and they were delighted with the taste of the cod as they brought it out of the water and cooked it on the coals on the banks of the Murray, some entrepreneur thought, well, wouldn't it be great if we got these cod and took them down to the Adelaide markets? Which they did. They killed the cod, froze them, took them down to the markets. But you know what? The taste was nothing like what you ate on the banks of the Murray. So I thought, well, we're doing something wrong. Perhaps it's the freezing process that's wrong. Perhaps what we need to do is put them in an aquarium with their natural water and transport them down to the markets, and people select the fish live and then take it and kill it there and take it home and eat it. And still the quality was not the same as what it would have been had you eaten it on the banks of the Murray River somewhere up in the Riverlands. Anyway, one day they managed to put a few cod in a tank, and there was also a few other species of fish went into the tank too. They didn't think to remove those fish, they just took them down to the markets. And lo and behold, when they ate those fish, which were transported with other fish in the aquarium, the fish had the same taste as if you killed it on the banks of the Murray River. So then they started to isolate the fish that were in the tank. Which one was it that helped the Murray cod taste sweet? And they isolated it down to a catfish. And they worked out that if they put catfish in the aquarium as they transported the cod to Adelaide to the markets, the taste was brilliant every time. What's so special about catfish? Catfish are a natural predator of the cod. And so sometimes we need a few catfish in our life so that our offering is sweet for God. Right? You know the story, the verse, the text, proof text that we quite often trot out of the Acts, that it is through much tribulation that we'll enter into the kingdom of God. Now I believe there's a lot of joy, an incredible amount of joy that we have. And the tribulation that we do experience is one of the things that I'm going to talk about this morning. Because we are actually related to two realities in this system in which we're living now, in our preparation for life in the kingdom. A lot of people call what we're living now a probation. Who's heard that? This is our life of probation. Well, look over your shoulder and tell me if you can see a probationary officer. No? Well, we're not on probation. We don't have a probationary officer watching over us, waiting to catch us out. You know, perhaps it's our convict mentality, which, a lot of Australians harken back to convict days. Our roots are convicts. I think Steve's family came out the first place, didn't they? I'm not sure.
They didn't, they should have.
Ancestry.com.
But a lot of us could trace the roots back to convicts, and unfortunately I believe a lot of Australians have a convict mentality to spirituality. And a lot of Christians think about this life that we live now as a probationary life. We are not on probation. This is life. And we're getting ready to move to the next level. And what realities that we're related to. Now, I'm going to base my remarks on Matthew 24, and I'd like you to just open your Bibles to that verse. And I'm particularly thinking about the last six or seven verses in that chapter. And I'll just read them for you. It says in verse 42, "Watch therefore, for you know not what hour your Lord doth come. But know this, that if the goodman of the house had known and watched the thief would have come, he would have watched and would have not suffered his house to be broken up. Therefore be ye also ready, for in such an hour as you think not, the Son of Man comes." And then there's this intensely personal, interesting question that the Lord poses. Who then is a faithful and wise servant? Who? How can we be marked as faithful and wise? Whom his Lord hath made ruler over his household to give them meat in due season. Blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he comes, shall find so doing. Verily or truly I say unto you, that he shall make him ruler over all his goods. But, and if that evil servant shall say in his heart, and I suggest perhaps that this is a man who started off as a good and faithful servant, doing the things that I'm going to share with you in just a moment. But as time progresses, something happens with his reasoning, and he becomes an evil servant, saying in his heart, "My Lord delays his coming, and shall begin to smite his fellow servants, and to eat and to drink with the drunken. The Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he looks not for him, and an hour that he's not aware of, and shall cut him asunder, and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Well, what's this all about? Well, obviously the Lord wants us to be ready for him when he returns. And a lot of Christians get hung up on verse 44. "Therefore be ye also ready, for in such an hour as you think not, the Son of Man comes." Lord, I'm not ready. I'm going to do this, and I've got to do that, and I haven't got this right in my life. I'm not ready. Well, relax, because the Greek is kind. "Therefore be ye also getting ready." This is a process, not an event. Okay, "be ye also getting ready, for in such an hour as you think not, the Son of Man comes." Now, I didn't mention this just once, but I come from a Christadelphian background, and up until about 15 years ago, I thought Christadelphians were a bit on a stick, and that we were the only ones that were going to be saved. Sorry about all you other poor Christians out there, but you didn't believe what we believe, so therefore you didn't have a hope of salvation. But in the last 15 years, the lights have come on for me, and I realised that there are so many Christians who have heard the message, who have heard the gospel, who have heard the good news about Jesus, and they too are getting ready for the return of the Lord. Yeah. And the world is full of them.
Yep.
Unfortunately, our churches aren't full of them, but we perhaps need to go out and connect more with these people. Perhaps they've had bad church experiences and don't like coming to church halls or buildings. So what does it mean then when the Lord says in verse 44, "In such an hour as you think not, the Son of Man comes"? I mean, we can see in the signs of the times and the way that prophecy is being fulfilled and the way that God's working the earth that Christ is just about here and the kingdom is just about to be established. How can he catch so many people flat-footed, as that verse might imply? Well, let me give you an example, and I'll pick on Leo. Say I lived in West Australia, Leo, which is where I come from originally, and I rang you up and said, "Hey, Leo, my wife and I are coming over to visit you, and we're going to be there on September the 11th, and the plane gets in at 3 o'clock. Don't worry about coming to get us. We'll catch a cab. We'll come down to your place, and can we stay 2 or 3 days? You confer with your wife," and she says, "Yep, that's fine." So we're ready. We're all packed and whatever. So you know that I'm going to be arriving about 5 o'clock on September the 11th. In the afternoon, by a cab, right? I guarantee when we knock on the door and we open the door, the first thing the hostess says, "Look, come in, but excuse the mess. I haven't had a chance to do the dishes today. The washing hasn't been hung out. I was going to get around to the ironing, but Leo wanted me to do something earlier and I didn't get to." Just visitors always catch us with the house looking like it always does. Don't they? And that's exactly what Jesus is saying here. When he comes, He will catch us with the house looking like it always does. So how should the house look? Well, as I said, there are two realities in the Bible. And we come across these two realities here. And I do wish this thing was just a little more proactive.
I wonder if it's a battery.
I wonder.
Is it, what size battery is it?
I have batteries here. Let's take the mystery out of this. Put a couple of batteries in it. So perhaps you might do that.
Yeah, that's all. Yep.
And I'll just persevere with this. So there is reality one, and there is reality two. Reality one is the reality into which we were all born. By birth, we were all born into the Adams family, weren't we? All together, eeky, kooky, spooky, and dysfunctional. Okay? You all seen the Adams Family show?
Yeah.
Right? Well, you know what I'm talking about. You know, there's no, the superannuation in the Adams family stinks. There's no eternity in the Adams family. There's no one who can bring about salvation in the Adams family. The first, our forefather in the Adams family, died of a snake bite, didn't he? And so there's no suitor in the Adams family who can marry us, who can take us out of this situation and give us a better life. And so by birth we're born in the Adams family, which is altogether dysfunctional, but by grace we come into God's family, and we do that by choice, when we understand who God is and what he is doing. People who are in reality one seek to overpower others. They want power over others, right? We call them control freaks. Reality one is very much described for us here in verses 48 and 50 of this chapter in Matthew 24. Reality two, though, are people who are like Jesus, who seek to empower people. What did Jesus do with the woman at the well of Samaria? What did he do with the woman taken in adultery? What did he do with the woman who came and poured ointment all over his feet? What did he do with Zacchaeus? What did he do with any who came to them? He didn't seek to have power over them. He got underneath and he gave them power. Go, sin no more, he said to the woman taken in adultery. Not that she would never sin again. It's an impossibility for human beings. But that she had choices in this life, and those choices have consequences. And so he empowered her to a better way. And so what we're going to see is that life in Christ is a reality to life. And Steve mentioned at the last fellowship meeting that we had held over in our hall at Pine Rivers, he talked a little bit about, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one God." Not telling us so much that God only has one head, if I can use that term, and not three, but telling us that God is unique. The God of Israel is one of a kind. What's he like? Well, I'll tell you what he's like. Jesus says it here in verse 45. The man who is in reality two gives meat in due season to the people who are in the household. Kai, Sharon, Rick, Harry, come on in. Okay, the word household there, only used four times in the New Testament scriptures. One other occasion is in Luke, which is the companion record to hear in Matthew. Another occasion is in Luke, where it talks about the healing that Jesus did. And the final occasion, which we won't go to, but you make a note of, is in Revelation 22, verse 1, the last chapter of the Bible, where it talks about the leaves of the trees, that's the saints, I believe, in the kingdom age, who will be for the healing of the nation. Same word. This word here is the word therapeuta. Therapy. What's therapy, Leo? You're in the business. It's healing, isn't it?
It is.
Okay. So what is a house of healing? A house of healing is called a hospital. That's right. So you know what? Our congregations are hospitals for sinners, not five-star motels for saints. And it says there, meat in due season to his household. If you've got a Bible on your lap, just flick back to Psalm 145 and have a look at this. Using a big water. Psalm 145, and let's go into verse 13 because we don't have a lot of time. Your kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, verse 13, Psalm 145. And your dominion endures throughout all generations. The Lord upholds all that fall and raises up all those that are bowed down. That's the language of a doctor. A doctor does that. He upholds all those that fall and raises up those that are bowed down. The eyes of all wait upon you, and you give them their meat in due season. You open your hand and satisfy the desire of every little living thing. This is the picture of God that we have. Open hand. It says in Isaiah 59, the Lord's arm is not shortened that it cannot save. How do you shorten your arm? You close your hand. What do you do with that? You make a fist. How can I, with a fist, accept this cup of water coming to me? How can I give a cup of water? I've got to open my hands to take it, to receive, and to give. How can I write a letter with a clenched fist? How can I pick up a telephone and make a phone call to my brother or my sister with a clenched fist? How can I put a coat on my brother or my sister with a clenched fist? How do I prepare a meal with a clenched fist? How do I drive a motor car with a clenched fist? You can't do it. You have to open your hand. So Matthew 25 is telling us that those who will be with God for eternity are in reality too. They are open-handed and open-hearted with the things that God has given them. And they share those things. You see, in reality one, life is an illusion, a distortion, a fantasy, and a lie. Okay? It is not forever. It's a brief now and then nothing for eternity. Whereas life in Jesus, life is a reality. Life is authentic. We can be authentic. We can be who we are. We can be our creative selves. We can express ourselves in a godly way, in a safe environment, and we can encourage and empower others. It's a true or a truth experience. In reality one, as I mentioned before, people who are in that system, and we're all born into it because we learn very, very early on that if I cry this cry, Mum does this. She changes my nappy. If I cry this cry, Mum does this. She gives me some milk. If I cry this cry, and there's about seven cries that babies have, it's a universal language, Mums learn it, Dads scratch their head, thinking, now what did the little critter just ask for just then? But we learn very, very early on to have power over others. So as little tackers, when we're born, you know, and as we grow, we have power over others. We get what we want. We manipulate what we need to survive. That's not wrong. That's our survival mechanism. What is wrong is when you're still doing that when you're age 50, 60, and 70. Not having an appetite, but having power over others and controlling other people. Whereas in reality too, with Jesus, we empower others to be all that we were created to be. So everybody has the opportunity to express God in their lives in an appropriate, authentic, true manner. In reality one, we find that there is a sympathy chip missing. You know, those of you that are IT nerds, you'll know that you have little chips that you put into your computer. Okay, well people who are in reality one lack a few chips. They lack an empathy chip, they lack a sympathy chip, they lack a humility chip. Reality two, the man who is in the hospital, as it were, looking after all of God's people, bearing in mind that he could well be the next patient. So he deals kindly with others because that's how he'd like to be dealt with himself. He has mutuality with his fellows. He is co-creative with all those that he has to do with. He is constructive. When I'm saying he, I'm using the generic. I mean he slash she. Constructive, not destructive. place for us here in Matthew 24, using those verses from 45 to 47, shows a picture of a man who is doing what God does, with an open hand, sharing the things that God has shared with him. How do we know that? When we come over the chapter, over the page, bearing in mind there are no chapter divisions in the original Greek, Jesus gives two famous parables. One is the parable of the virgins with the oil, and the other is the parable of the talents, the three men being given varying amounts of talents. The question is, what would a faithful and wise servant do with those talents? We don't have to guess, because two examples are given. The man who was given five went and traded with the same and made another five. So he took what God had given him. I believe it's the gift of grace, but somebody might have a better idea. And he shares that with others. What happens? It brings forth fruit fivefold. So maybe five others come to learn of God as a result of me, that man, sharing that grace with some others. The other man, he was given two. And when the Lord returns, he finds that he's also multiplied the investment 100-fold. The point is not the size of the investment. The point is that God's word has gone out and it hasn't returned to him void. It doesn't matter whether it's five or two or ten, it doesn't matter. What does matter is that the man who took that talent and froze his Lord's assets, dug a hole in the ground, buried that gift up with the sweatband off his head, that's what the napkin is, Luke 19, because he wasn't going to raise a sweat in the Lord's service, and then sat on it, he is counted as an evil, controlling servant. So the Lord wants activity from us. He wants optimism. He doesn't want pessimism. He wants optimism. He wants enthusiasm. He wants us to go out and to share what we have with others. It can't be tarnished. This truth, this grace that we have in our hands today, it's been around for 6,000 years. Who looked after it while you were here? Before you came along. Who's going to look after it after you've gone? It's robust. It's not a hothouse violet. It's made to be taken and shared. So my message today is to let's empower each other to go out and to mix with people who are looking for Jesus. Go find them. They're in all sorts of places. And one of the really, really key things that I've learned since the last meeting we had together, I've had a bit to do with a man by the name of Duncan Heaster, who in Christadelphian circles probably has been the one man who has baptized the most number of people into the Lord in our 150-year history. Would that be right, Steve? There would be no other more prolific evangelizer than Duncan. And he's very unassuming, very quiet. He's not out there and in your face like I am. But he says to people, would you like to be baptized? That she's leading. Would you like to be baptized? And I'll either say, oh, yeah, well, I was christened as an infant or whatever the answer might be. But that's his lead in. And from there, he takes it and he works with them. And it's just amazing how he gets people to come to the Lord using that as a lead in. So let's open our mouths. Let's share what God has given us. Picture of the evil servant, on the other hand, he wants to protect. He wants to preserve. So the first man serves. The second man wants to preserve. Preserve. How do you preserve something? You pickle it, you boil it, you poison it with sugar. You do all sorts of things to it to keep it in the state that it now is. Right? God doesn't want us to preserve his grace. He wants us to use it. He wants us to share it. He wants us to get out there and open our hands and with abundance let other people have a taste of what we have been given. So in reality one, the evil servant is busy in his fantasy world, and as Micah 7 verse 3 says, he's got two hands full of evil. Two hands full of evil. He does evil with both hands full. Whereas the man in reality one, man or woman in reality one, is busy in God's hospital, he has two hands full of grace, as we saw in that psalm that we just had a look at just a minute ago. So I'm just going to do a quick comparison now, and I know comparisons are odious, but this works for me. If we're still in reality one, then we will be insecure and fool-like. What is it fool-like? Well, the evil servant says in his heart. Well, that's where the fool has his conversation, isn't it? Psalm 14. Well, the fool says in his heart. Go through and make a Bible study of that little phrase, in his heart. Very interesting. The Pharisee said, in his heart. If Jesus had known what manner of woman this was, he would, well, hang on a minute, how did the Pharisee know what manner of woman she was? How did he know? And he said that in his heart. And Jesus says, I've just got something to say to you, Simon. You know the little conversation you just had with me? Well, there's a little parable, you know. A man was a banker, gave out a little amount of money to one, a big amount of money to the other, and he forgave them both their debt. Who loved him more? Well, it's a no-brainer, says Simon the Pharisee. It was the guy that was given the most. So Jesus says, this woman has been forgiven much. Of course she'll love me more. Go see it, Simon. So the opposite in reality too is that we are secure and we are father-like. That is, we do what the Father does in our relationship with others. Reality one, people are fearful. They have no trust. They are always suspicious of others. Well, what did Jesus say in Matthew 5, 6 and 7? He talked about those that gave the evil eye. Well, how do you give an evil eye? You close it down and you look narrowly with suspicion. And that's what the Pharisees did to Jesus all the time. They were always giving him the evil eye, always suspicious of others. Whereas Jesus himself was faithful, trusting God, and empowering others. You do that with your eyes wide open, and your face open, and your hands open, and your body language is open. And people go away empowered to become more like God. That's what we're here for. Reality one, in Psalm 94, a verse that Nicky found yesterday, and brought to my attention again last night. They frame laws and bring misery as a result. Life by law is no life at all. Whereas in reality two, Jesus gives substance and shares blessings via grace. Reality one, the evil servant used his fist as a weapon. And worse than that, in reality one, actually, it's Matthew 24 here, when he began to smite his fellow servants and to eat and to drink with the drunken, the word smite there is to continually pummel. And it's actually a word related to the practice, I believe, that the Spaniards perfected through the Inquisition called bastinado, where they laid the victim down on the floor and strapped him so he couldn't move, the soles of his feet upward, and they took a cane and they caned his feet. And of course, you imagine that. Our feet are full of really, really exquisite nerve endings, and it's one of the most tender parts of our body. And so every painful step in recovery after that, the man who was beaten remembered the treatment of the one who beat him. And so using anything as a weapon is not on. Whereas Jesus shared benefits with open hand. So in reality one, the evil servant tortures others, whereas in reality two, the faithful servant nurtures others. Reality one feeds his own ego. He meets his own needs by controlling others. In reality two, the faithful servant feeds all the household and meets the needs of others, and in so doing, is like God. Reality one is narrow-minded, reality two is open-hearted. Reality one cannot accept himself and therefore cannot accept others. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind and strength, and love your neighbour
as
yourself. That's right. So if you can't accept yourself, we're talking in language of Australian men here. Australian men have a problem with using this word love in the Bible. Well, change it to the word accept, and you'll find it works. Right? Accept the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And accept your neighbour as you accept yourself. That works. you can't accept yourself, you won't accept others. Jesus accepted himself, who he was, and as a consequence was able to accept his neighbour. The prime motivator of reality one is fear. There's only two motivators in life, fear or love. And fear is a very, very poor substitute for love.
Yeah.
Reality two has karma, not fear, in his heart. Reality one promotes shame and guilt. Reality two promotes healing and blessing. Reality one is driven by the fear of failure. Reality two is led by the Spirit of God. See the difference? You're driven or you're led. Okay? And our challenge is to be led by the righteousness of God. Reality one is rigid like his arteries. Reality two is flexible like God himself. And when Duncan Hester came amongst us recently and spent a weekend talking about Hosea and Gomer, the prostitute and the prophet was his title. And it was just absolutely fascinating how he shared with us that God so often puts aside his own laws so that grace can operate in full. So we don't have to be rigid and stuck to the Old Testament way of doing things when Jesus has shown us the more perfect way, the way that God has had in operation right from the very beginning. The other is an aberration in the process to teach us that we cannot do it by the Lord anyway. Reality one creates idols to control others. Do you know what an idol is? Anybody got a definition for an idol?
Anything to take God's place in your heart.
Right, that is a standard Christian answer. Think about this. And you'll find it in the Message Bible in Ezekiel 20. They wanted to create idols with their hands that they could control, like all the other nations, it says in the Message Bible. And they, when I read that, that's the key. An idol is something that I create with my hands or my intellect that I can control.
Yeah.
God hates idolatry. Why does he hate idolatry? Because idolatry is when I create something with my hands or my intellect that I can use to control others. That's why God hates idolatry. Not that we've taken our attention away from him, but that we're using it to get to his people and control them when he should be the one that's in control. Doesn't that put a whole different slant on what idolatry is? Work on that. Reality two worships the God of heaven and earth in spirit and in truth. Reality one views life through a toilet roll. Well, this is about the only prop I use in my talks these days. Because this says it all, doesn't it? Yeah, I can see Steve. I can't see very much else. But if I focus on Steve, I can, yeah, he's got a few glaring faults there. My dear, I should realise that, you know, I've got faults too. But while I'm looking at Steve, that takes the attention off of me. Right? I can't see anything much else at all. While I'm looking through this toilet roll, how many Christians do you know that live life through a toilet roll? Right? Heaps. Heaps and heaps. And we don't have to live life looking through a toilet roll because we've been given the big picture to share with others. Reality one becomes a shriveled waste of space. He shall cut him asunder and appoint him his apportion with the hypocrites. That's the language of sacrifice at the altar. Cut asunder. That's what they did with the sacrifice. They cut it asunder. They cut it in two and opened it up and inspected it. And in the case of the evil servant, God opens up the evil servant, or Jesus opens up the evil servant and says, can't see my father's DNA in here. No family likeness here. Into outer darkness there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. That's not, oh shucks, I've lost the lotto. That's, they told me it was grace. And I refuse to embrace it. Right? It's more than just I've missed it. They told me what it was, and I refuse to embrace it. Weeping and gnashing of teeth. And you know what? Do a word study on that. Every time that phrase occurs in the Bible, weeping and gnashing of teeth, it occurs in the context of grace. Every time. Reality two, in Jesus we become all that we are created to be. So in summary, Reality one is what we want to get out of. Reality one is what we want to leave behind. Reality one is the Adams family. We want to get out of that. They're manipulative, they're controlling, they're destructive. They put others down so that they can stand taller and look better in their own eyes. Reality two is all about mutuality, which is one of the things I'm loving about meeting with the restoration people as we are today. We don't all share the same scriptural beliefs as, you know, to every point of teaching in the Bible. I refrain from using the word doctrines because doctrine is a state of being. And the state of being that I've been talking about this morning is the state of being in grace. That's the only reality, is that's the only doctrine there is in the Bible, I believe. That's the one that's going to go into eternity. The grace reality. All the other things are teachings. And beliefs and teachings can change over time as we grow in our understanding and our knowledge and our experiences of life. We can abandon what we once thought about how Jesus was tempted and embrace another way of thinking about it and still be right with God. Okay? The doctrine part of it is living in grace. Because unless we're living in grace, we aren't right with God. We've got to embrace His grace. And so mutuality is one of the things that I'm treasuring with working with all of you. Co-creating is another one. Empowering. What a wonderful word that is. Validating others where they are on their journey at that time and giving them the tools or sharing with them the tools and having them share with you their tools to help one another in the journey. And so at the end of the day, there is only one reality in the Bible. It says in Deuteronomy 32, speaking about a time yet future, God's talking about His doctrine shall come down like rain upon the mown grass to refresh the earth. That's not telling us that Mary's not the mother of God. That's not telling us that God is one and not three. When Jesus in Matthew 5, 6 and 7 finished his Sermon on the Mount, what we call the Sermon on the Mount, they were blown away. They were astonished at His doctrine. They weren't blown away with the fact that Mary wasn't the mother of God. Pick a teaching, any teaching. They were blown away with His state of being. His relationship to things eternal and to all others created. That's what doctrine is. There's only one doctrine. And it's reality too. There's only one reality. Because when the kingdom is established and it's all handed, and it's all finished and it's all handed back to God the Father, it's only grace. Remember Zechariah? Going to complete the picture. Put the capstone in the arch. With shoutings crying, grace! Grace unto it!